Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, November 20th, 2023. I'm Lou DeVizio. I apologize for not having an episode up last week. I've been feeling a little bit under the weather, and we're doing a bit of cramming ahead of the holidays at this station, but we still have some great interviews for you this week. In about 25 minutes, Our Land's Laura Paskus speaks with Eric Jan. He's the legal director of the New Mexico Environmental Law Center, and he's going to explain a recent decision from Albuquerque City Council to disband the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Air Quality Control Board. That decision also will replace it with a group that environmentalists fear will be friendlier to polluters. That's after city councilors passed two bills earlier this month, both introduced by District 5's Dan Lewis. Now, as Eric Jantz tells Laura, his group sees the move as a deliberate attempt to avoid a regulation that would limit industries in neighborhoods that are already overburdened with pollution. But for a majority of the show, we're going to be talking about a case in U.S. District Court in Maryland. That case has implicated two former lawmen here in New Mexico. A federal indictment alleging a cross-country machine gun scheme named former Bernalillo County Sheriff Manny Gonzalez and his undersheriff Rudy Mora, who also served as police chief for Laguna Pueblo. Neither have been charged with a crime, but according to the indictment, both Gonzalez and Mora falsified documents to help firearms dealers illegally obtain more than 1,000 machine guns and short barrel rifles. It's a crazy story. Executive producer Jeff Proctor will speak with Diane Layden about it. She's a member of the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Office Advisory Review Board. Jeff will ask her why there were no checks and balances in place that might have kept Gonzalez from signing bogus letters to help gun dealers import automatic weapons. But we're going to begin with a little deeper look into the indictment itself and what it means for the two former New Mexico lawmen. In a conversation with Albuquerque Journal criminal justice reporter Matthew Risen, Jeff asks him about the facts of the case and if there's a possibility of criminal charges against either Gonzalez or Mora.
Matt Risen, welcome to New Mexico in Focus.
Thanks for having me.
So we will get to Manny Gonzalez, Rudy Mora, and the local connections in a moment, but I would like to begin with part of what was in the headline on your October 26th Albuquerque Journal story, which mentioned a cross-country machine gun scheme. Based on the indictment that was filed in U.S. District Court in Maryland and your reporting, what was the scheme and how did it work?
So there's a man named Sean Sullivan. He lives out east. He's a gun dealer. He's also, at the time of this, was a Department of Homeland Security analyst, and he works for BNT USA, which is like a silencer gun manufacturer importer type. But he has the ability to import guns, restricted guns, guns that aren't allowed to be manufactured in this country, so you have to import them. And basically what happened was Sullivan had a friend named Larry Vickers, who was Delta Force, big gun enthusiast, has a YouTube channel, millions of views, he reviews guns, loves the AK-47 apparently, has one signed by Kalashnikov or...
Boy.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I didn't see that part.
No, yeah. That was in my other research. But basically, Sullivan had Vickers, who Vickers knew police chiefs in various areas, and Vickers would ask for a favor from these police chiefs for them to sign documents. These documents are called law letters. And what a law letter is it allows for the importation of a machine gun if it's for the use of demonstrating to a law enforcement agency for possible purchase. So basically, like a chief of police can say, well, hey, I'm interested in buying this machine gun or this restricted weapon, they can sign a law letter stating that on like a department letterhead. And then basically they would give these letters to Vickers as a favor though. They didn't actually, these were small departments. They didn't have SWAT teams. One of them actually only had one sworn officer and that was the police chief. So they would give these letters to Vickers and then Vickers would give these letters to Sullivan who would turn them into the ATF on an application to import guns and basically pay for machine guns and the ATF would approve these requests based upon these law letters. And then Sullivan would be able to import these weapons, and then him and Vickers would split them up amongst themselves. They would sell some of them. They would post them online. Keep the ones they like. Yeah, no, they would like show pictures and be like, oh, I want that one. Or like, give me the one with the sling. Mm-hmm. And then they would sell some of them for like $100,000. They're like, and then give them to collectors. And there are other people who are named and not charged who were involved in kind of like being given the guns, buying the guns. But that was like
some of that. Yeah. But one thing I want to get to quickly off the top here, the feds call those machine guns. What are some of the guns we're talking about here?
So some of the guns we're talking about are Glock 18s, which are they're Glock pistols, but they fire automatically. Some of the guns were it's FAMAS. I don't know how you pronounce it, but it's like might be FAMAS. Those were like automatic weapons. Silencers are considered NFAs, like NFA weapons. And then, like, we're talking, like, war relics. Like, we're talking guns that need a trailer to be moved from place to place and need water to cool them because they fire 950 bullets in a minute.
Oof. So what is required to be able to put your hands on this kind of firepower? I'm going to get calls from people who say it's okay to own these sorts of weapons, but if you want an MP5 or an Uzi pistol, you talked about it some in your first answer, but what do I have to do to have one of those guns?
You would have to be a federal firearm licensee, so basically a gun dealer, but you would also have to have licensure to, you have to get a license to be able to possess, transfer, or buy NFA firearms. NFA firearms are firearms restricted in the National Firearms Act, and that was an act that was put in place a long time ago and basically just banned automatic weapons, short barrel rifles, silencers, parts that make guns automatic.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So that's going to get us a little bit to Manny and Rudy. I want to go back to kind of the design of the scheme. I love the way you put it in your story that you should think of it like a doctor writing fraudulent prescriptions for his friends. Who was who in that analogy in the scenario we're talking about now?
So in that analogy, the doctor is a police chief. The friends are gun dealers, gun enthusiasts, gun collectors, and the prescriptions, the drugs, are like automatic weapons. So yeah, it's pretty wild stuff.
So who were Manny and Rudy in this particular scenario? And let's get to some specifics while we're at it. In this indictment, let's make it clear so far that they have not been charged. Neither of them is facing any charges at this time. But how many of these law letters did those guys write, and how many guns are we talking about?
Between them, they wrote over 100 law letters, and they requested hundreds of guns.
Almost 600, just yes. From Manny, right?
Yes, just from Manny. Hundreds of guns between the two of them. And basically, they requested various firearms, restricted ones. The only ones we know about was the FAMAS rifles, automatic rifles, and then the Glocks, the automatic Glocks. They requested several of those. And those actually got imported on those requests. It's unclear if they ever made it here or into anyone's possession here, but they made it into the country.
So we don't know what became of the guns they requested, right?
We don't.
That is an outstanding question that I'm sure you're pursuing, as a number of other reporters probably are. I want to go back to the law letter situation, though. So in this instance, they'd have to sign this letter that says, I would like to perform this demonstration. I'm thinking about buying some of these guns. The best we know so far, did Manny or Rudy or either of the other two law enforcement officials ever plan on conducting these demonstrations or having these guns in their arsenals?
To our knowledge, no. I mean, in the indictment, it says that both Gonzalez and Mora had no expectation that these guns would ever be demonstrated or purchased. And there's actually emails in a separate petition where basically an ATF is denying one of the requests that Manny did, basically in saying that in the denial that Gonzalez himself said there was no use for these guns and there wouldn't be a use for these guns.
Did he go back to ATF and make a subsequent statement? I think I remember that from the reporting. Did he offer some contradictory answers?
Yeah, so this all happened in like a several month time period. But basically they reached out to him and said, hey, we're reaching out to you because we flagged that these guns are being requested. These don't seem like they were World War II relics. One of them was the gun that has to be on a trailer. And like, these don't seem like guns you would need. Did you approve these law letters? Because if not, this, you know, basically explaining the loophole and stuff. And so, and then they sent another email that was like, hey, a gun dealer in Florida is now using a law letter signed by you, like for Gonzalez, obviously. And so they set up a meeting, and then apparently at that time, Manny told them, I don't need these guns. The gun requests were denied. But then a meeting was set up with Mora, Manny, Larry Corin, the BCSO SWAT, and then ATF, and James Tafoya, a gun owner in town.
We'll get to him in a second.
A meeting was set up, and apparently at that meeting that Manny told the ATF that they were valid and authentic letters. And this is after he said that he would have no use for those weapons.
Okay, one other thing I just want to get clear during all of this. Manny Gonzalez was the sheriff of Bernalillo County during the period of time that this went on. It went on for 5 or 6 years, if I remember correctly.
5 or 6 years.
And Rudy Mora was his undersheriff when Manny was at BCSO, but the allegations, sort of naming him, the period of time that he was signing these letters, what was his job then?
He was the police chief for Laguna Pueblo.
Okay. So the local connection for Manny and Rudy, the person they were writing these letters for, is a guy named James Christopher Tafoya. Why might my viewers remember his name from before?
James Tafoya, it was when there was a big protest downtown. A lot of APD's officers were downtown, and during that time, someone went to his gun store on the west side, and they cut the power and broke in, and they stole more than 100 guns. None of them were the NFA guns. I actually verified that. But they stole more than 100 guns from the store, and they never found who was... They never charged anyone for that crime, and most of those guns are still out there somewhere.
Has Tafoya been in the news otherwise before this? I seem to remember one other story that might have involved him.
Yeah, I wrote a story, a package about straw purchasing, and I kind of wanted to find out where a lot of it was happening. And basically what I found was that Tafoya's was one of two gun stores where most of the charged straw purchasing offenses originated in the state. Meaning that that's where people went and said, this gun's for me, when really it wasn't for them.
Woof. So the ATF knew who this guy was before any of this. At least they should have known. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. They'd been approving NFA weapons for him for a long time before this stuff happened.
So I want to go back to the two other law enforcement folks who were mixed up in this whole thing. One is a police chief from North Carolina, the other from a tiny department in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. What are they alleged to have done, and how is it, if it's different, from what Manny and Rudy are alleged to have done?
So what they have done is they had signed law letters for Vickers and for other co-conspirators who are not charged, but not even named, actually just initials are in the indictments. But they had signed law letters requesting machine guns. What the ATF had in the indictment is actual text message communications between them where it's like clear that this is like Vickers asking for a favor, or you know, this other initialed person asking for a favor, and they are clearly saying, okay, I'll do it for you this one time, or you know, like I, you know, you owe me one, which clearly points like this was not about them getting machine guns. The difference between what they did, as far as I can tell, what they did and what Gonzalez and Mora did, I don't see a difference personally. The only difference between them, I think, is that Gonzalez and Mora, when they were at BCSO, they actually had a department that had a SWAT unit. They had like a lot more officers. Those two police chiefs were like, one of them was the only sworn officer for the department, and the other one just had like a couple dozen or maybe a couple dozen officers.
And Manny sworn. And Rudy signed a lot more letters for a lot more guns too, yet they're not charged. One question I have, and I'll ask if you know, are you aware of any ongoing investigation related to this?
I reached out to the U.S. Attorney's Office out there in like Maryland, where this is like being charged out of, and they would not confirm or deny that an investigation was even occurring, which is...
The classic federal response, Matt.
It's silly, yeah.
Okay, so at this juncture, Manny's not talking, Rudy's not talking, they're not talking to you, they're not talking to me. Best I can tell, they might be talking to a handful of lawyers around town. Who is talking is John Allen, the current sheriff. Mm-hmm. He had a news conference not long after the news broke. What did you learn then?
He basically came out and said, look, here's the NFA weapons that we have. And it was really interesting. You know, they have some World War II relic guns. They don't have ones that need trailers, but they have ones that like shoot 900 plus rounds a minute. They have Bushmasters, which is like, you know, like carbine rifles. They had a sawed off double barrel shotgun.
Sheesh.
Yeah, and basically another thing that was interesting that came out of that, though, was they found out in their audit that there were a couple dozen AK-47s at Laguna Pueblo that belonged to a private citizen, and there had been some kind of communications where deputies had had to go to Laguna Pueblo and get the guns and bring them to BCSO's armory. Mm-hmm. And I'm still looking into that whole thing, but that was basically something that came out of that too, where like he was unaware that those guns were in there. He said he was unaware those guns were in their armory, and so basically they had to then find that private citizen, and I believe they relinquished the guns to him after tagging them into some kind of evidence system.
Matt, I'm not going to ask you to tip your hand, but I've known you long enough to know that you've still got questions here. Briefly, we got about a minute left. What are some of the questions you still have?
I'm kind of curious what happened in that meeting between ATF and Manny, and I'm curious what happened after that, because according to another petition, Tafoya wanted his guns back because they didn't charge him for years after they charged Sullivan and Vickers. And in the petitions, he basically says that after that meeting with the ATF, where Manny said they're valid and authentic, that the ATF began approving more letters between the parties. And so I'm kind of interested, like, what played out after that. I'm interested in, like, this private citizen with these AK-47s, because, like, I mean, that the fact that they were at Laguna Pueblo and then they were brought to BCSO, apparently under the orders of the leadership, is very coincidental when you think about Mora and Manny both being involved in this. So, I mean, those are just some of the questions I have at this point.
Well, I will be looking forward to reading the answers you find, and I know that pretty much everybody else I know will be as well. Thanks a ton for joining me today and breaking it down.
Thanks for having me.
I'll be back here at the table in a quick second with Diane Layden, who sits on the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Office Advisory Review Board, to talk about why oversight and accountability have been challenging in New Mexico and beyond for decades when it comes to sheriffs. Diane, we've been talking over email and otherwise about policing and police accountability for many years, and I am thrilled to have you on New Mexico in Focus. Thank you for coming.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
We've just spent a bit here at the table talking with Matt Risen about this case involving, potentially implicating, Manny Gonzalez and Rudy Mora, involving a multi-state machine gun scheme, as the federal government describes it. But what I would like to talk to you about are the systems in which this took place. You have been observing Bernalillo County sheriffs and other aspects of county government in various capacities of your own since long before you and I met. What have been some of the highlights, lowlights, and themes that have emerged in the last 40 or 50 years that you've watched this?
I worked for Bernalillo County in the mid-1970s. I was hired in the personnel department and became the personnel director, and then became an assistant county manager for labor relations when the county unionized, and the sheriff's department was the first department that did. There have always been questions about the county working with its independent elected officials, and some of those officials have been more independent than others. Sheriffs notoriously are independent in New Mexico. And Sheriff Manny Gonzalez claimed that New Mexico sheriffs have unlimited powers. This isn't accurate. The county has budget authority and ordinance-making power, and the state government regulates, local governments. But with that viewpoint, Sheriff Gonzalez was able, for example, to refuse to discuss ever body cameras with the county commission, although the commission had brought forth the money to buy body cameras. So it took a state law to be passed in June 2020 for Bernalillo County to have body cameras when APD has had them since 2012. In terms of other events over the many years, Sheriff Joe Wilson in the mid-1970s was removed from office for backdating a memo authorizing county cars to go to the racetrack. And I believe two of his employees, his chief deputy and undersheriff, spent some time in prison over this matter. So there have been ups and downs with independent elected officials, and not only the sheriff, but sometimes the treasurer or the assessor.
We'll get to those other positions in a moment too, but you've mentioned the word elected a couple of times in sort of the early part of our conversation here. What are some of the other challenges from an accountability and transparency perspective that nature of the office? These are elected positions, not appointed positions. What other challenges has that presented for county government?
Okay. Well, the sheriff, for example, is mentioned in the state constitution in terms of his or her duties. The county commission doesn't have everyday authority over these officials. Yes, they're subject to county ordinances, but the commission doesn't know what's going on in county offices. And that's how these letters could have been written by Sheriff Gonzalez and Under Sheriff Mora without anybody knowing about them. And there wasn't a dialogue. There is no legal oversight required of the sheriff.
He doesn't answer to the commission, right?
Officially, he does not answer to the commission.
So they do it a little different in the city of Albuquerque, Diane, on the law enforcement side. The police chief is appointed by the mayor, hireable and fireable by the mayor. As we've just discussed, the sheriff is an elected position. Are we looking there at sort of the two edges of the proverbial democracy sword?
Of course, the performance of the sheriff depends on the quality of the sheriff who is elected. Certain sheriffs could, of course, have warm relations with the county commissioners. And I believe that relationship may exist now between Sheriff Allen and the county commission. That's my impression as an outsider observer. I think state law would have to be changed for sheriffs to have more accountability. Currently, they can sign contracts without a legal review by the county commission staff, by the attorneys that work for Bernalillo County. I know this. This came up when the On Patrol program became controversial. That was a TV program in which law enforcement officers followed Bernalillo County deputies. And they stopped a woman after she had had a car accident. She came to the sheriff's board with her story, with her boyfriend and her mother. She had been placed on national TV without her consent. It was at those meetings I discovered that the sheriff could sign a contract with the TV program, and there was no legal review required. Now, he could request a legal review, but he didn't have to. So the sheriff has great autonomy at Bernalillo County and apparently throughout New Mexico.
And throughout the nation, too. You mentioned earlier that notion of ultimate authority. Manny is sort of aligned with what a lot of people refer to, and they refer to themselves, as the so-called constitutional sheriff's movement. What kinds of challenges does that present in terms of systems of government working together?
Okay, the constitutional sheriff's movement believes in no power higher than the county, really. There's actually a group called Posse Comitatus, which means power of the county. It's a right-wing group. The sheriff's constitutional movement doesn't believe in the authority of governors or the federal government. It believes in its own authority. And so we saw that Sheriff Gonzalez did not completely comply with Governor Lujan Grisham's public health orders, the mask mandates and the vaccines. How do we change that? I want to mention that in Texas, I've been told that in Texas, sheriffs do not have contractual authority. One of the members of the sheriff's board, Jim Stewart, was a sheriff in Texas, and he said sheriffs there don't have that authority. He was surprised that New Mexico sheriffs had contractual authority. So this is one area we could look at for greater accountability.
I want to talk some more about the board in a moment, but one more question sort of on the systemic bit that we've been discussing here. When you see something like this story that's broken in the last month, where the top elected law enforcement official in our county and his number two guy are alleged to have been involved in a big multi-state machine gun scheme, in particular in the middle of what's been going on in our community. We've had tons of residents and an increasing number of residents die and be wounded by bullets here. There's a gun violence epidemic in our community. Mm-hmm. So when people see this, something like this, what does this do to faith in government institutions and leaders for the public, especially at a time when that kind of faith is already sort of waning?
Well, now this certainly undermines faith in the sheriff's office and local government, although perhaps not in this sheriff. Who is looking into this matter, to have written letters to obtain guns that people then could sell to collectors and others who want to get a hold of machine guns and short barrel rifles to do that. Now, Matt Risen's article said that they don't know if Sheriff Gonzalez benefited from this arrangement, and that's something we still need to find out. And that may be a reason why he wasn't charged in this indictment, but was named. We don't know. We don't know the degree of his culpability, if any.
And those kinds of questions leave doubt for the public too, right?
But why the sheriff would do it, why his undersheriff would do it, that's the question. Why would they go to this trouble to write these letters, to obtain these guns? For other people, apparently, for collectors and gun dealers and so on, at a time when guns are a major political issue and public safety issue throughout our country, and especially here in Albuquerque.
So, Diane, I want to go to a paper that you prepared for the Historical Society of New Mexico about the formation, the God particle, if you will, of the Sheriff's Office Advisory Review Board. It sounds like Manny's tenure in office was a big catalyst for the creation of that board. Tell me some about that board, on which you sit, of course, and how it functions.
Okay. I was appointed in 2021. The board was formed in September 2020 by the County Commission. The ordinance creating the board was written by James Colley, who was a member of the County Commission for 1 year. He stepped in to complete the term of Maggie Hart Stebbins, who left the County Commission for a state government position. I interviewed Jim Colley. I also interviewed Maggie. Jim told me that when he joined the commission, that's all other commissioners talked about is what to do about the sheriff.
And that frustration you mentioned before.
A particular concern was the body cameras and the inability of the commission to get the sheriff to adopt body cameras. I wish to say for myself, I met a sheriff's deputy where I live with his gun at the ready. He was chasing a suspect. And this was back before body cameras. And I ended up writing three letters to the Journal about this. Albuquerque police carry body cameras and have for years, but there's a sheriff's deputy in my neighborhood looking for a suspect with his gun at the ready, and there's going to be no record of what took place.
So we've talked some today about the sort of struggle for accountability and oversight. I know that neither of those words is in the title of the board you sit on, but how is it supposed to function? What is its relationship to the Sheriff's Department? And what are some of its limitations?
The name of the board is the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Advisory, Sheriff's Office Advisory and Review Board. We are not an oversight board. This issue arose when the ordinance was written. This ordinance isn't like the initial civilian police oversight authority that was set up at the city, which was oversight, and they were reviewing disciplinary cases. We don't do that. We are intended to provide access to the public to come to the board and bring their issues to us, and they have. I mentioned the On Patrol case. Also, the sister of Elisha Lucero Elaine Maestas came to the board about the killing of her sister by sheriff's deputies. The family had called the sheriff's office for help. The sister is mentally ill. She allegedly came out with a knife and they killed her with 21 bullets. Now, this was an expensive lawsuit and is one of the reasons the sheriff's board was formed. This lawsuit and another lawsuit involving the killing of another man in a truck. He was an innocent person, but he was in a truck that was being pursued by sheriff's deputies. Those two cases, I believe, cost the county about $7 million. So in terms of the formation of the sheriff's board, there was concern about the lawsuits as well as the absence of body cameras and the unwillingness of the sheriff to even discuss that subject.
Did Manny participate with the board? Did he allow that board to advise and review his department?
I missed much of the first year. The board started meeting in November 2020. I joined in June. But I've been told that Manny never came to a sheriff's board meeting. His undersheriff, Larry Corrin, and a couple of other of his leading people did come to sheriff's board meetings. We did have a presentation on how the county sheriff's office protects the schools. Okay. The current sheriff has been more open with our board and has sent more of his people to meet with us.
That sounds like a step in the right direction.
We think so.
Diane, thank you so much for coming in and helping us understand the context for what this is taking place.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Thanks to Jeff for those two interviews. Now, we're working to better understand the reasoning behind two bills that Albuquerque City Council passed last week, both of them from Councilor Dan Lewis. One of them abolished the Air Quality Control Board, which is a joint venture between Albuquerque and Bernalillo County. The other bill set a moratorium on new air quality regulations until February of next year. Now, to get a grasp on why City Council took such drastic action, which the county opposed, Our Land senior producer Laura Paskus sat down with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center's legal director, Eric Jantz. The two talk about that and also how this isn't the only place in New Mexico where elected officials and policymakers have favored industries, placing profits over people, as Jantz put it.
Eric Jantz, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Laura. Great to be here.
Thanks. So the Albuquerque City Council last week voted to abolish the Albuquerque-Bernalillo County Air Quality Control Board. Mm-hmm. To start with, what does a board like that do?
So the Air Quality Control Board is a board created by New Mexico statute that is, their main job is to regulate the air quality within Albuquerque and Bernalillo County. The State Environment Department regulates air quality outside the county, but it's the responsibility of the Air Board to make sure that those of us in Albuquerque and Bernalillo County have clean air to breathe.
Okay, so this board that was abolished, will something replace it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing about this Councilor Lewis's legislation, is that it purges the current board and replaces it with folks who are presumably more industry friendly. And the really interesting thing and actually kind of troubling thing about this whole process has been that these bills are specifically targeting a particular rulemaking proceeding, right? So industry hasn't been happy with the way things have gone. And so rather than go through the designated process, they've chosen to seek some other redress.
So what is that rulemaking process?
Yeah, so that rulemaking involves a petition being filed with the board. The board can decide to either hear the petition or not. In this case, they did. The petition gets heard, currently is scheduled for December 4th through 8th at the Civic Center. And at that point, everybody who is involved, both industry and people who are supporting the rule, will have the opportunity to present expert witnesses and evidence about why the board should either pass this rule, reject it, or make some changes to it and pass that. So, you know, the process really hasn't even started yet. The board hasn't heard any evidence, hasn't made any decisions. That's why this is so alarming, right? Is because the board, Councilor Lewis has sort of put a roadblock in this legitimate and lawful process in order to make sure that it doesn't happen at all.
So you've been working with communities in the South Valley for this health, environment, and equity impact rule. What would that rule do?
So essentially, this rule identifies the most overburdened communities, those communities that have highest concentration of polluting industries, but also the ones that have have the most health impacts, have the highest levels of poverty, and other social vulnerabilities that make them more susceptible to illness from air pollution, from exposure to air pollution, air hazards, right? It identifies those communities. It requires a permit applicant to go through a process of identifying who's in the community, what the concentrations of air contaminants are in the community already, doing risk analyses, and then the Environmental Health Department, which is responsible for issuing permits, takes a look at the report that the industry generates and that communities had the ability to comment on, and make a decision about what sort of pollution mitigation, monitoring, and reporting requirements they're going to put on a particular operation.
So it sounds to me like a community who is confronted with legacy pollution and new polluting industries moving in have worked together within the system to move forward protections for their public health and environment, and now the Albuquerque City Council has stopped that process or harmed that process. Why do you think Councilor Lewis and four of his colleagues would do something like this?
I think that that's a question for the councilors. My suspicion is that they've been told that this rule, even though there isn't a rule yet, there's a proposed rule, but as I said, the board hasn't made any decisions, that this proposed rule is going to completely shut down economic development in Bernalillo County. That's nonsense. We hear this all the time. And I've been working with communities professionally for 20 years. And every time there's a new sort of regulation proposed or rule proposed or law proposed, the first thing we always hear is this is going to destroy economic development in the county, the city, the state, or wherever, right? And invariably, these industries are able to adapt to the new regulatory landscape. It's just a matter of whether or not they have the political or the will to do that. There is perhaps some economic dislocation, but economic ruin has never happened.
Right. So, the United States Congress passed incredibly important environmental legislation in the 1960s and 70s. And Americans overwhelmingly want things like safe drinking water, clean air, clean water. And yet, over time, those laws are consistently weakened, or like we see here, new rules and regulations aren't allowed to go forward. Why is that?
Honestly, Laura, I think it really comes down to profits over people. And squeezing the last little bit of profit out of every operation, I think, for some people, matters more than the common good of being able to protect people's health. And it's interesting because ultimately, protecting people's health and having clean air, water, land, whatever, is a lot more economically beneficial for the whole rather than keeping sort of dirty air, dirty water, dirty land, right? When the Clean Air Act was passed, industry squawked about how it was going to ruin economic development, but it turns out, study after study has shown that the return, the economic development from having clean air under the Clean Air Act outweighs the cost of compliance by like 30 to 1.
Right. So I think you and I have known each other for close to 20 years. I think we first met when you were working with the Navajo Nation to ban uranium mining within the Navajo Nation. You've worked with communities all across New Mexico who face challenges in having either legacy or new polluting industries, who lack access to clean water, clean air, a safe environment. What do those communities have in common that, you know, maybe lots of our audience members just take for granted?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that sort of the thread that runs through everything is those communities are largely communities of color and often low income. There's been a wealth of research over the decades showing that the best predictor of where polluting industry gets sited is whether or not there's a community of color nearby.
I keep thinking about how, there are all these laws in place and there's a system in place that's supposed to be in place to protect people from pollution, from unsafe conditions. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we see time and time again communities in New Mexico who try to work within the existing structure and the existing system. For instance, with the health impact or the health environment equity impact rule, working within the structure that exists, and then you have elected leaders who come in and change the system, change the rules. What are people supposed to do?
I mean, that's a really good question. The communities who face these issues are really used to that sort of game of whack-a-mole and are very adaptable. I think that as this process unwinds, whichever way it goes, the community folks that we're working with and the vulnerable communities throughout Bernalillo County will adapt to it. I mean, they're not going away. They are committed to making sure that the air that they and their families breathe is clean, and really the air that all of us in Bernalillo County breathe is clean. We see this all the time. It's just a matter of having to be creative and adapt.
Right. And just sort of lastly, what should the rest of Albuquerque, people up in the Northeast Heights, people, in communities that maybe aren't impacted by these very polluting industries, how do people need to better support their neighbors and community members?
Right. And again, this doesn't impact, poor air quality doesn't just impact disadvantaged or vulnerable communities, right? Under-resourced communities. They impact all of us. It's just a matter of when. It's going to happen sooner or later. And so folks who don't live in communities of color or low-income communities or communities that are vulnerable because of social determinants of health like poverty, access to health care, food insecurity, things like that, can support those communities and themselves by getting engaged in processes like this. So, for example, urging the mayor to veto the pieces of legislation. And if he does that and the council decides they want to try to override the veto, making sure that their counselor votes the right way.
Right. All right. Well, thank you, Eric. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Laura.
Thanks again for listening, and be sure to follow our pages on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube throughout the week. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio. For Monday, November 20th, 2023, this is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.